So first, just a little primer on what's in your brain. Your brain's basically made of four. It's a little fuzzy. Amber suggested that we might be able to get these slides available through the Nerd Night website. So if you want to look at them later, because there's going to be some citations and stuff that you might want. You're not going to be able to read it like this. So anyway, your brain is basically made up of four different parts. There's the cerebrum, which is what most people call their brain. That's the upper part of the brain. And that's the lobes, you know, the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe. That's your cerebrum. The cerebellum is the second part. That's kind of tucked underneath and on the backside. And that has three lobes. And that's responsible for a lot of things that you almost think of as being a reflex, but you actually learn them. Things like walking and riding a bike and doing sports. If you've ever been in a sports team and you keep messing up in competition and your coach says, just let it go. Just let it go to muscle memory. He's actually your cerebellum memory is what he's talking about. But that's kind of what your cerebellum does. And then there's an area sort of in the middle of your brain called the diencephalon, which is an incredibly important part of the brain that controls like your whole internal environment, things like your hormones and your water balance and your sodium balance and all that kind of good stuff, your energy balance. And not my bank balance, that's for sure. And then the last part of the interesting thing about the diencephalon being in the center of the brain is that's actually where the retina of your eyes begin their development when you're a little fetus. You've got the retina of your eyes are actually part of your brain, and they're the only sensory organs that have connections that can actually do processing in the sensory organ itself. So your eyes, the back of your eyes at least, they're originally started out as part of your brain. And then I asked Justin to go a little too fast. The last part of the brain is the brainstem, which you've all probably heard of called the lizard brain or whatever. This is the midbrain, pons, and medulla. And these are the parts of the brain that actually keep you alive in the most basic sense. This is where your heart rate, your respiration rate, blood pressure, things like that are controlled. All right, now we can go. All right, inside the cerebrum, I'm going to talk about the cerebrum mostly. The whole brain is covered by a series of membranes called the meninges, and the outer one of those is called the dura mater, which in Latin means tough mother. And it is. It is a very tough mother. It's some of the toughest stuff that's not bone in the body. And it actually connects into the bone. You know, when you see like on CSI where they take the little striker saw and they go, oh, here's the brain. No. No. Ask this guy. He takes out the best brain. Oh, he's like a master. So good at it. But it does not take 15 minutes, believe me.
I look for a man.
Well, you know, everybody has their criterion. But anyway, inside the cerebrum, which is covered by this membrane, is the parts of the brain that we're probably going to talk the most about, because that's what zombies would eat. If you get through that tough mother, you know, to get into the cerebrum, then you get this nice hunk of brain. But you'd have to go through another twice as thick piece to get to the cerebellum and the main brainstem. So you can get the cerebrum and the diencephalon, but the rest of the brain probably wouldn't get eaten by a zombie. So that's why I'm going to talk about the cerebrum most. There's gray matter and there's white matter. I'm sure you've all heard this. It's very interesting to look at the development of a human or any mammal, as far as that goes. We start off with our brain and spinal cord basically just being a little groove in our body and end up with what we've got here, which is pretty cool. And the brain kind of turns itself inside out and wrinkles itself up and stuff to make it bigger, which is pretty cool. And also to give us more surface area so that we can have more gray matter. Gray matter is where the connection connections are made. So that's really kind of the intelligence, if you will. You can make more connections. You can have more consciousness, more thought, more rationality. It's a good thing to have connections. So more gray matter generally makes you smarter. If you look at like different animals and so forth, your fish don't have a lot of gray matter. They're pretty good at being fish, but they really can't learn very much of anything else. So, but humans have a lot of gray matter, so we can learn a lot of stuff. And I suppose we could learn some stuff from the fish. But anyway, the gray matter is where all the connections are. And in order to make connections, you have to make neurotransmitters, and then you have to release the neurotransmitters, and then you have to receive the neurotransmitters on the next cell, and then you have to react to that reception. And all of those things require protein. So if you were eating just gray matter, you'd actually get a significant amount of protein from brain. But there's probably more white matter than there is gray matter. And white matter is the areas that are connecting the gray matters together. It's primarily what are called the axons, or the long extensions at the end of a neuron, that are making up the white matter. And they're connecting areas of gray matter where the cell bodies and the dendrites are, where all the connections are. And these sort of highways get slicked up with this lipid coating called a myelin sheath. And the myelin sheath makes things go faster, and it requires less energy to conduct electrical impulses if you have myelination. So it's a positive thing for the brain. But because of the way that we do it with these cells that are called oligodendrocytes, they're actually a different kind of cell. They're not a neuron. They're a different type of a... When you get the notes, just read this thing down here. But the oligodendrocytes create this myelin sheath, and it's mostly saturated fat. It's really, really high in saturated fat. So as far as eating goes, you probably don't really want to eat that much of it. Plus, the conduction process requires an enormous amount of sodium. So, you know, if you've got blood pressure problems, I don't think so. So if we look at this, the cerebrum, this is, again, kind of the prized zombie food here, the cerebrum. What does your cerebrum actually do? Well, again, you have these different lobes in different areas. The frontal lobe, the area in the front here, the cerebrum is made up of hills and valleys. The hills are called gyri, the valleys are called sulci. And a sulcus is a single one. So there's a little valley that separates the different lobes in different places. So separating the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe is the central sulcus. So just in front of the central sulcus is an area called the primary motor area. And I'm going to come over and look at the pictures. So this is a brain that's been cut coronally. And you're seeing here the gray matter in red. And there's a little what's called a homunculus. It's a proportional body based on how many sensory receptors are coming into the brain. So we have these ginormous hands and lips and itsy-bitsy tiny arms and legs and stuff. And that's the area that controls most of the motor movement, the voluntary movements of the body. And then we have Broca's area, which is only on one side, only on the left side, controls speech. Other than the prefrontal cortex, most of the frontal has to do with movement of some kind. And the speech one has to do with movement of the tongue and lips in order to make speech. If you have a damage to that area, you can end up what's called motor aphasia, where you do not have the ability to speak. You can think of what you want to say, but when you try and say it, you can't make your tongue and lips do what you want them to do. And so essentially you can, and the worst part of it is you can't even write. So it really cuts you off from society. And then another thing that we see in the frontal lobe is the frontal eye fields. They basically make sure that your eyes track together. So that if you're looking, watching something going from left to right, both eyes move left to right at the same speed. You can imagine how weird it would be if they didn't. So, but anyway, that's another thing that we have in the frontal lobe. And then also in the frontal lobe, we have basically the thinking part of the brain. This is what's called the prefrontal cortex or the neocortex, the newest part of the, evolutionarily, the newest part of the brain. And this is where we do thinking and planning and where our personality and impulse control, judgment, all those kinds of good things that we think of as making us human. They're all in the prefrontal cortex there. And when people say, you know, we only use 10% of our brain, that's basically what they're talking about, is that 10%, that prefrontal cortex. And my thought on that is it's only 10% of the brain that's doing 10% of the work. There's a whole lot else that the brain is doing besides just thinking. But anyway, moving on to the parietal lobe, which is the area just posterior to the frontal lobe, we also have another one of the gyri, this yellow one here, which is right next to the red one. The yellow one is sensation. It's all the cutaneous senses, so everything you can feel with your skin. So it's hot, cold, which are different receptors, pressure, vibration, several different types of pain, pressure. There's all kinds of stuff you can feel in your skin. And they basically all go to the same place. So that if you have damage in one of those places, you can get paresthesia, which is contralateral, that is on the other side of the body. The part that's being controlled by the damaged part of the brain is going to have no sensation at all. Sometimes you'll only lose one or two senses, but often you'll lose all sensation in that one area. Another really bizarre thing that can happen in this area is something called synesthesia, which some of you may have heard of. And that's where you can you sense whatever was coming in. You get that perception of the sensation, but it also triggers another sense. So, for instance, pressing your lips together not only makes you feel what it feels like to press your lips together, but also makes you see the color blue. And what's really interesting is the very small percentage of people in the population that have synesthesia tend to have the same sensations. That is, if pressing your lips together makes one person with synesthesia see blue, it makes probably most of the other people that have synesthesia also see a color that's in the range of blue, which is very bizarre, if you ask me. So then a little further back in the parietal lobe, we have a lot of association areas where we take the sensation that we're feeling and then we somehow integrate it with another function of the brain, like language. You know, ouch, that hurts. That's language. You can also, there's a part of the parietal lobe where you actually connect those sensations to the possession of that piece of your body. And if you have lesions in that area, you can get something called contralateral neglect syndrome, which I think is one of the most bizarre things in all neuroanatomy, where they're a part of the body, you can feel the sensations from that part of the body, and you can see that it's attached to you, but you don't think it's part of you. So, for instance, a guy might, you know, shave his whole face and leave this little spot here unshaved because that's not his. And whoever belongs to may not want to have it shaved, you know. So, he's not going to shave it. You know, I thought somebody made this up, but I actually know some people that work in the field of OT, and they've worked with people with this problem. They'll start buttoning up a sweater with one hand and unbuttoning it with the other one. This is very bizarre stuff. And then we get the temporal lobe. This is on the side of the body, of the brain. And we have hearing, which is one of our most important senses, up in the superior temporal gyrus. We also have some really cool stuff in the temporal lobe, which you're going to hear about in the next talk, that have to do with our emotions and our memories and so forth. And those are in the temporal lobe as well. So an area called the amygdala, which means almond, if I'm not mistaken.
Delicious.
Yes, delicious. Well, it's in the temporal lobe. You might get to it. It's right about here in the temporal lobe. It's on the inside. It's gray matter. And it's basically the doorway into your limbic system, which is your emotions and reward system and all kinds of fun stuff in that area. And the hippocampus and the parahippocampal gyrus are kind of tucked underneath, but they're still part of the temporal lobe. And those are very important in memory and also in emotions and in putting memories together with emotions. Like, have you ever, you know, walked past a bakery and you smell this bread baking and you go, man, I remember Grandma used to make the best bread. What made me think of that? You know, there's the memory of it was the bread. So that's your temporal lobe. And the other thing you have in your temporal lobe is something called Wernicke's area, where you have sensory speech. That is, you can understand what you hear. And if you have a problem with Wernicke's area, you hear just fine, but it sounds like gobbledygook to you. You just can't make any sense of it. And unfortunately, you also can't read. Don't know why that happens. And unfortunately, there's a white matter connection between Wernicke's area and Broca's area, that if there's a lesion in that area, you're basically completely cut off from any communication with anyone human. That's a really sad situation. The occipital lobe is in the back. It's the smallest lobe of the cerebrum, but it also is the only lobe that's given over specifically to just one sense, and that's the sense of vision. So that kind of gives you an idea how important vision is to humans. And we have vision. We have vision association areas, things like, you know, color, movement, that sort of thing. And we also have the occipital eye fields. The frontal eye fields made you track left and right. The occipitals allow you to track up and down. So that's another thing that happens in the occipital lobe. And then the insula is an interesting area. It's actually part of the cerebral cortex, but because the cortex is so folded over, it's actually on the inside. And that's why it's called insula, like it's insulated. And this is where we have our visceral senses, things like hunger, thirst, certain types of sodium and blood pressure get put into there. Some of the pain, especially deep pain, goes to this area. And also visceral motor, some of the things that can control things like some of your blood pressure issues and things like that. And there's one sensory organ. It's the palms of your hands. There's just one sensory organ that goes to the secondary sensory cortex instead of the primary up in the parietal lobe. And this it senses soft. And if you are ever upset, you know, somebody cut you off on the road and that person is such a gossip, you know, whatever. And you get home and you grab your dog or your cat and you're sitting there, oh, and talk to the dog and you're petting the dog and all of a sudden you feel better. That's because you have sensory receptors for soft. They go up to your insula. They tell your blood pressure, get back down. It's okay. So that's kind of what happens in your insula. Okay, next. Okay, and inside of the lobes, we also have areas called the basal ganglia. These are gray matter areas in this upper picture, which is really an atrocious picture, but that tells you my skills with a computer. These green areas here are all the part of the diencephalon. This is the thalamus, the hypothalamus. These are the subthalamic nuclei. The blue areas here are basal ganglia, and the red area is the insula. And then this little yellow area here is something called the substantia nigra, which is actually part of the midbrain, but it acts as if it were part of the basal ganglia. And basically what the basal ganglia do is they modify your motor programs after they leave the primary motor area, but before they get to the spinal cord, and they interact with some impulses that come from the cerebellum. So it's all really pretty complicated in the basal ganglia. But they're responsible for the fact that if you want to, you can go up and just pat, you know, somebody on the cheek and always, aren't you a sweet little child? And as other times you can go up and just whack the heck out of them. And you're using the exact same muscles. It's all the same, but it's the control of how much you actually use. So that's your basal ganglia. And problems with the basal ganglia basically cause two things. They either cause positive signs or negative signs. Positive signs are things that happen that you don't have any control over. You don't want to make that movement, but you do anyway. An example is something called bilismus, which is a case where you have a problem with the basal ganglia, and it just causes you to just sort of fling your limbs out. You know, people have gotten shot for less in places like Missouri, and this is actually something they can't control, and that's a positive sign. And then the negative sign is it's a movement that you want to make, but you're not able to. You know, if you want to move your arm up to here, and this is as high as you can get it, you know, that's a negative sign. And so those are the kinds of things that you see with the problems with the basal ganglia. The substantia nigra, if there's a problem with that, actually, if there's a problem, it's very common, it's the most common neurological disorder of the elderly, is a problem with the dopamine in the substantia nigra, and that's Parkinson's disease. And you end up with both positive signs and negative signs in Parkinson's disease, so you just can't win with that one. And then also inside the cerebrum, we have ventricles, which are fluid-filled cavities. I guess that's where the zombies get their liquids from. Too much cerebrospinal fluid can cause problems, especially in infants. Can cause hydrocephalus. It's a problem. There's very little biologically that's astoundingly important about CSF, but it's pretty important in the fact that it's there and that it's constantly moving around. All right, well, this one didn't come out real good. For some reason, I couldn't find information on the nutrition in a human brain. But I did fight for Lambre, and I figured we're both mammals, you know, that's not too far off. So a survey, a 3-ounce survey, which is about the size of a deck of cards, which, you know, that's not a whole lot. I'm just going to give you 123 calories, which isn't all that much. But most of it's going to be fat, like 77 calories are fat. And a lot of it is saturated fat, not huge amount, but certainly some. There's actually zero carbohydrate in brain tissue. Now, if you were a zombie and you were eating something, you would actually get a trace of blood in there. So there'd probably be like a little trace of glucose and, you know, maybe a trace of calcium or something. But for the most part, you wouldn't get any of those good things. You would get some protein. You'd get a whole lot of fat. You get enormous amount of sodium. You get 500% of your daily allowance of sodium in one little, and then it's almost, what is it? Almost six times your daily allowance if you don't have cholesterol problems with cholesterol. So if you have problems with cholesterol, it's like 9 times more the cholesterol than you should have in one serving for a day. So really, it's not a nutritious food. You can get some vitamins, but there's no calcium. There's a whole bunch of sodium, a little bit of potassium. It's not really that good food. All right, so what's going on in your brain right now? Some of you are listening to me fairly intently, and if that's you, then you look like that top brain over there, because where you got the yellow and the red, that's an MRI of someone who's listening to something intently. That's the superior temporal gyrus that's lit up. So someone is really thinking hard there about hearing. The one right next to it, the blue and the red, the blue is an area where you're trying to, if you were trying to make a decision about something. So if you really weren't sure, you know, about this talk, that area might be lit up. The red area right next to it is the areas that would be lit up if you were like trying to not fidget. And then on the bottom one, this is really interesting. This one, the bottom one is this is somebody who's daydreaming, okay? And the way that they figured this out is the coolest thing. The people that were running the MRIs, the techs, they're running the MRI the whole time, whether the doctor's in there or not. They still have the equipment on, because if you turn it off, you got to wait, you know, like 7 hours or something for it to heat up. I don't know. So they're running the MRIs even when the doctor's not there taking data. And over time, all of these techs that worked in this one area kind of went, you know, when they're not doing anything, there's a certain area that's kind of always lit up. So it was the techs that saw this. It wasn't the doctors. So it's here for the techs. And what they found out is that the areas that are in red dots, there's some up in the prefrontal cortex, there's some back in the association areas for the parietal lobe, and some out in some of the other more language associated areas. And then all of the little blue lines are white matter connections between those dots. And basically what your mind is doing when you have this default, this is called the default network. What happens when the default network is working is basically you're running through everything that you've done recently. It's like dreaming. You're running through everything that you've done recently and you think, boy, when she said that, I should have said this back. You know, boy, if that happens on the road again, I'm going to make sure that I swerve just, you know, where it's at. And you know, you run through all these scenarios that you've done in your life, and it's basically a way of learning. So, not much time. Okay. So anyway, that's the default network. So if you're just kind of daydreaming, that's what your brain's going to look like. So what's happening in the rest of your brain? If that's what's happening in the 10%, you know, you only use 10% of your brain. What's happening in the other 90%? Well, let's see.
Zombies.
Yes. Zombies. That's all. You don't need anything. It's just zombies. Go ahead. So when I was preparing this, one of the things I read, just basically to the next slide, when I was reading was I read about there's all these new studies on medical marijuana because of all the medical marijuana stuff, and the people on what there's like two groups, you know, there's the people who are against it who think that it's going to turn everybody into zombies, and then there's the people who are for it who think that it'll cure everything under the sun, and the truth is obviously somewhere in the middle. I can't actually read the because it's not, but there's a pretty good quote there that is basically, you know, there's not all that much evidence in, but the evidence that's in now is that marijuana is a lot less dangerous than most of the things that it's usually associated with, like heroin, methamphetamines, and most importantly alcohol, because alcohol is obviously the closest analog. It's clearly less dangerous than any of those, but it's not harmless.
Oh yeah, she's and,
I'm also an employee of a local university, so. No. But basically, the research says, you know, it's really not good for adolescents. It does have, there's evidence that it could do things like lower your IQ points. Yeah, that's not something most people are interested in. But it's really hard to tease that out from things like malnutrition and poverty and stuff, which is going to affect the same population. So it's kind of hard to tell. But that was sort of the, so my conclusion was, it's probably not a good idea. For adolescents to use, but it certainly isn't going to turn them into a zombie. And because you have all these endocannabinoids in your brain and then you add more to it, the problem is you might make yourself a really, really appealing target to real zombies because they have all those cannabinoids. So, yeah, just do it.